I'm Richard Mackey of the UBC Law History Project, and it's the 6th of January 2014, and I'm in the Vancouver Club in a boardroom on the third floor with Right Honourable Kim Campbell. Welcome to the project.
Thank you so much.
I asked you a little bit about your island roots, and I was hoping you could go back over some of that ground and describe the Cook family, was it, from Vancouver Island?
Yeah. Well, I am the fifth generation of my family to have lived on Vancouver Island and the third to be born there. My mother's family, the Cook family, came out from Nova Scotia. We think in about 1870, 1871, they took the American Railroad out to San Francisco, actually, and bought a boat, which they put provisions on, went north to Victoria, where they sold the boat and provisions, and with that money went to Nanaimo and established the first dairy farm in Nanaimo. My great-great-grandfather was Ephraim Cook and his son Ezra. And I think the dairy farm was on an island in the Nanaimo River. I think when the tide was up, you had to take a boat across, and when the tide was down, you could walk across. And I do know that they went to, I think it was Chimanas, either Cowichan or Chimanas. They went to the Bonsall family to buy a cow, and they took the cow back. And the next year, with the monies they had made from milking the cow, they went back and paid the Bonsalls for their cow. And years later, my grandfather, when he was a young boy, he was born in Nanaimo, Carl Cook, Carlisle Edward Cook, he would go and spend summers with the Bonsalls. So the friendship between the Cooks and the Bonsalls was a long time one. And then I see the name Bonsall, B-O-N-S-A-L-L, on the island in occasional places, and I think it must be the same family. So my grandfather met my grandmother, who had come from Scotland. She came from Scotland in 1912, and they met somewhat later because they were married in 1921. But my grandfather trained to be a dentist. His father had died when he was still at school, and he had to look after the family, and his mother decided there wasn't money for him to go to medical school. So he went, like many people on the West Coast did, to Portland, Oregon, to study at the dental school there. And when he was finished, he and my grandmother got married, and they had their honeymoon in the Empress Hotel in Victoria in 1921. Now, my grandfather moved his family to Port Alberni because he thought that small towns were great places to raise children, raise family. And it's always amused me that he didn't think Nanaimo was a small town, but he took the family to Port Alberni. And in fact, the house where my mother grew up has a little plaque on it. Not because the first woman Prime Minister of Canada was born out of that house, although I was born in the hospital, but because my grandfather, Carl Cook, was the first resident dentist in Port Alberni, and that was his house. And he was a wonderful man, and a hunter and conservationist, and taught the kids how to swim, and was just a great guy. But he tragically died young in 1939 of a heart attack. So my grandmother kept her house during the war, and during the war, my mother shocked her family by joining the Navy. She graduated early from high school. She was very smart, had the highest IQ in the history of her high school. Her name was Phyllis Cook. And she went to Esquimalt and signed up for the Wrens and became a wireless telegraphist, tracking German U-boats in the North Atlantic and Gulf of St. Lawrence. She was stationed in Halifax and Saint-Hyacinthe and Moncton and Ottawa. But when she married my father, who was living on the island or was stationed there, he was in the Canadian Army, she went to home to her mother's house in Port Alberni to have both her children. My sister was born in 45 and I was born in 47. My dad was overseas when my sister was born, but when I was born, my father was a student at Victoria College and was studying for his BA. And he was commuting back and forth between Port Alberni and Victoria. And I was induced so I could be born when he was at home. But 6 weeks after I was born, my family moved to Vancouver. So that was the end of my island involvement, because my I was born at the General Hospital in Port Alberni, but lived there only briefly. And then after my mother moved back to Vancouver with my dad and her two children, my grandmother eventually, I think, sold her house. And that was the end of residing there.
Can I ask you a little bit more about the your island connections. And I'm biased here because I'm an islander and have written these books about island history. So I hope you don't mind a bit of a digression. What was the name of the what were some of the other family names apart from Cook?
Well, our island family was really just Cook. Mm-hmm. Because it was just my grandfather and his siblings. His sister Frieda became Frieda Simpson, and she married Jack Simpson. My grandmother's family, I think her sister married in Devereux, and I think the Devereux are on the island. Devereux. Mm-hmm. Those are other names that you might find of old island families that are associated with us, but those are the only names that I know.
Scottish?
Yeah, they were.
Grandmother?
Yeah, my grandmother was born. She was Gardner, Elizabeth Hill Gardner. But her stepfather's name was Brownlee. So her brother took the name Brownlee. My grandmother didn't. She was the oldest of the three children. So she remained Elizabeth Gardner until she married my grandfather and became Elizabeth Cook. But the Brownlees moved to the United States. Although, many years later, my mother's cousin Patsy Brownlee, went out with some friends in the States. I'm not sure whether they lived in California or someplace, and snuck out to go and see a Frank Sinatra concert. And the next thing she knew, she was a student at St. Anne's Academy in Victoria. Huh? So she was sent to St. Anne's, although she was from a Protestant family. They sent her to St. Anne's Academy, where actually she said she was very happy. She spent 3 years there in high school and had wonderful education and great music teaching. And as a result of that, and many years later, when my mother wanted to send my sister and me to boarding school for a year, we also went to St. Anne's Academy. Mm-hmm. So St. Anne's Academy in Victoria was also part of, I was there for grade 8. And many years later, when the Sisters of St. Anne were celebrating the 150th anniversary of their arrival in British Columbia, I think that was in 2003, I may be wrong, but they came, I think, in 1853. I try to remember because the original little wooden building that they used was still on the site of
St.
Anne's
right
Academy
there beside the
when I
museum.
Was there. Anyway, they invited me to be a keynote speaker at the big dinner they had in Victoria. So here was I, a Protestant girl. Although, interestingly enough, I won. There was a medal for private schools, a Governor General's medal for private schools that was given to the top grade 8 student when I was in school. And St. Anne's was one of the schools that awarded this medal, and I won it. And I remember the nuns saying to me, you know, please, you know, do a little work and study because you're going to win this medal and we want you to win it by a mile because all the Catholic families will be mad that this Protestant girl is winning this medal. And so there I was also giving the keynote speech at the anniversary, but I talked about what it was like to be a Protestant at a convent school. This was before Vatican II, when the nuns wore the habits and the long beads, which was only fair so you could hear them coming, and the mass was still in Latin, and it was a really interesting part of my education. But the Sisters of St. Anne's mission was to go out and teach and nurse in remote areas. So it's interesting, their mother house was in Lachine, Quebec, but when they came to British Columbia in the mid-19th century, Victoria was a remote and distant area. So they created St. Anne's Academy as a school, and then across the street was St. Joseph's Hospital. So they played a very important role in the development of Vancouver Island. I think they had another school maybe up island a little bit, and then they had schools in New Westminster and in Vancouver. Little Flower Academy was their school in Vancouver. So that was an interesting part of my life, too. So, and years later, before I was elected to the legislature, which also brought me back to Victoria, I went to work for Premier Bennett. This is the only time I've ever worked as a political advisor. And when I was working for Premier Bennett, I got a message from my assistant that there was somebody there to see me who said she was my grade 8 teacher. And when I knew her, she was Sister James Marie, because pre-Vatican II days, the nuns used a variant of the name Mary and the name of a saint, and she was Sister James Marie. But she was now Sister Eileen Donegan. They had gone back to using their names, and she came in, and she was wearing a trench coat and slacks and hush puppies, and I said, Sister, you have hair, because I had never seen her hair, because she'd been wearing the coif and the, you know, the wimple, the things that they wore. When they were in the habit. So Vancouver Island was kind of an interesting part of my life, both from my family history there, but then going back to the provincial capital, where for my family, I guess it all began when they arrived in the mid-19th century to early 19th century to sell their boat and goods and get the money to go to Nanaimo.
Can I ask one more question about the Nanaimo family? They were they arrived and had a dairy.
Yeah,
So were they tradespeople originally in Nova Scotia?
Well, they must have been. I don't know. My mother's cousin Alice Marwood, who was the daughter of her uncle Gord, the youngest of the Cook boys, has done a genealogy, and I can actually put you on to her. And then somebody else got in touch with me who had done a genealogy of the Nova Scotia Cooks. And we had thought that our family had come from Massachusetts, but I think the branch that came from Massachusetts was called Stevens, who came in 1650 to Ipswich and Amesbury. This person had done a genealogy of the Cooks, who had come in 1791 from Londonderry. They were Scots-Irish, and lived in, I think, around Truro, Nova Scotia. So I have roots in the same place as Robert Stanfield. And then Ephraim Cook and his son Ezra went out to BC in, we think, around 1870, but they'd come to Nova Scotia in 1791.
So was education an important part of the family ethos for the children to become
the dentist? I think my grandfather, as the oldest one, was the best educated. I think he was the only one that had any university education. And I don't know how educated his father and grandfather were. But again, I suppose there were more opportunities. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Ezra or Ephraim had any education beyond public schooling. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong, but I don't think so.
No.
But it was part of the Scots have always valued education, mm-hmm. so even when they were transplanted to North America, I think that was important. Mm-hmm. But my grandmother was a school teacher, mm-hmm. Went to normal school and taught school. And in fact, when the baby boomers hit the school, she had to quit teaching when she got married, because married women weren't allowed to teach. You know, God forbid they might get pregnant, and the little blighters might wonder how that happened. Uh-huh. So years later, in the mid-50s, when the baby boomers hit the schools and there was a huge shortage of teachers, my grandmother, then heading for 60, or almost 60, took a refresher course and went back to teaching, and which was a very interesting role model for me, because she didn't teach in the city. She went to little communities around BC. She taught in Linton. She taught in Burns Lake, where she had to board with a farming family, and there was a porcupine in the outhouse, and she taught in Armstrong, British Columbia. So she had some very interesting assignments.
And that's your mom's mom.
That's my
mother's
brother.
Mom.
Yeah. So, but she was a Scot, and she, was well educated in Scotland and trained to be a teacher when she came to British Columbia. So for her side of the family, it was. I'm not sure. I mean, my grandfather had wanted to be a doctor, and it was when his mother decided after his father died that there wasn't enough money for that that he went to dental school. And I think my grandmother helped him, and hers was the first debt he paid back when he started practicing dentistry. And she had always felt, a bit embarrassed maybe that she'd lent him the money, but they were deeply in love and very, very happily married. And the best thing that ever happened to my grandmother, who was raised by a Victorian mother who told her that when she asked where babies, her mother died of cancer, and when her mother was dying, she asked her where babies came from, and her mother said, anything you need to know, your husband will tell you. And she had the great good luck to marry my grandfather, who was a wonderful, loving, earthy man. And my grandmother discreetly conceded to my mother years later that she and my grandfather had a very lovely, warm physical relationship. And, as my mother said, she grew up in a house where, her parents always, they never passed each other without touching each other. It was a very physically warm family and demonstrative. So it was the best thing that happened to my grandmother, given the fact that her own family were pretty abstemious in the old physical affection. I'm sure they hugged one another. My grandmother was a very warm and huggy person, but she didn't know much about sex, so she married an intelligent, earthy man who adored her, and they had a very happy family life. But he tragically died young, and that was a great tragedy. My mother was only 14, and I was a terrible loss for her. So anyway, that was partly perhaps why our connection to the island changed. My mother's older sister moved to Ontario when she got married. Her younger brother went into the Air Force and was stationed in Germany. So the family basically didn't stay on Vancouver Island.
And your parents, where did they?
My father was born and raised in Montreal. of Scottish family. His family was pretty dysfunctional. His father disappeared when he was young. And I'm not actually sure how he fetched up in British Columbia. He was in the army when he met my mother. They were both in the service. And they married in 1944. My dad was sent overseas in the fall. My father enlisted in 1939 and was in the dental corps. I think that was what had brought him into Vancouver Island, and was lobbying to be sent overseas the whole time he was in the army. And finally, in the fall of 1944, when my mother was already expecting my sister, he was sent overseas, and he fought with the Sea Force in Italy and was wounded there and bleeded out to Britain. Came back, and my sister was born in March of 45. So my dad was not there when she was born. And I guess that was why my parents wanted him to be there when I was born, because he missed the birth of his first child, because he was in an army. I think he'd been wounded by then and was in an army hospital. So, but dad was born in Montreal. I think some of his childhood he spent in Buffalo, New York also. He had a difficult childhood, but he was. And it's interesting, I mean, his family were not Francophones, but he was always proud of having some connection to French. And when I was a child, his birthday cards to me were always signed Ton Père Quitem. Yeah. Father who wants you in French. Huh. So. Mm-hmm. A small footnote.
Mm-hmm. So he
missed the birth of my sister, but he was able to be there when I was born. 1947, my parents moved back to Vancouver. My dad finished his BA at UBC in 1949 and took a year off. So I was at his BA graduation. There are pictures of me as a little tiny toddler. I mean, I was just barely two when he got his BA. And then he enrolled in UBC Law School and graduated in 1953. Hmm. And I think his was sort of one of the last classes of the veterans. I think Pat Proudfoot was in his class. Mm-hmm. It was a small class, if you look at it. And there were a couple of women in the class. But it was sort of the last of the kind of the veterans group, and then the classes filled up with non-veteran students. So I was at my father's graduation from UBC Law School, and in fact there's a picture in the old law building. There was a picture on the grass out overlooking Chancellor Boulevard that said Faculty of Law, and I have a picture of my father and my sister and me standing in front of that sign. Years later, my sister and I would both graduate from the UBC Faculty of Law, where that sign still was there. So we are second generation UBC law students.
What did your dad do before his law
education? He just took jobs with, he was in 1939, he was 19 when he enlisted. He was born in 1920. So he was in the army until he got out after the war and went to school. So he did a bachelor's degree, a BA, and then an LLB. And he had various jobs. At one point, he worked for the Fisheries Research Department on the whaling boats up off the north coast of British Columbia. We had a picture of him sort of standing in the mouth of a sperm whale. We had two whales' eardrops that were something. But his job was to take certain glands from the whales that were used for research.
That almost sounds like the kind of job you would get as an undergraduate.
Yeah, well, that's how he got it. And he was taking science because at that time he had wanted to go to medical school. And he didn't get into medical school, he went to law school instead.
Somehow I missed, when I was sort of doing an internet research, I missed the fact that he also had a law, that he was also a UBC law graduate.
Yeah, well, it's in my bio. Autobiography. It's all the story there. Yeah. No. So my dad, he opened a private practice on Kingsway for many years. Then he moved downtown, and then eventually he said one day he got a big envelope that said employers' obligations under the Canada Pension Plan, and for a sole practitioner this was like a big bureaucratic nightmare for him. Mm-hmm. So he'd done quite a lot of criminal law in his practice. In those days, lawyers, if they wanted to practice alone, they just sort of did everything. It's barrister and solicitor work and everything. So he said, Stuart McMoran, the city prosecutor, what have you got in the prosecutor's office? So they hired him, and he became a city prosecutor, and he finished his career as a prosecutor and was very good at it. And he really liked it because it meant he could do the lawyering without a lot of administrative work. That wasn't what he really liked to do. And it was interesting, as my sister would say, that because she did more criminal work and then she eventually became a Crown, how very highly regarded my father was. Some people felt that he was, you know, very, very fair-minded and would always, you know, one lawyer said, if he said I didn't have a case, I knew I probably didn't have a case. And so it was his, I think he also at one point was made a justice of the peace to create the experimental traffic court where people could make appointments to come and fight their tickets if they wanted. And I remember years later seeing a program on television about such a thing in Toronto. I thought, well, my dad got that started out here years ago. But he was made a justice of the peace to do this, and that created some confusion because the dean of the law school used to always think that my father was a judge. I said, so you don't know he's not a judge. He's a lawyer, but he did. For a period of time, he served this thing, and he went back. But he ended his career as a Crown Counsel.
And so, did you, you moved back to Vancouver, or to Vancouver, when you were 6 weeks old?
Yeah.
And so that your dad could go to university?
Yeah.
Is that,
yeah. Yeah, he'd done, I guess, the first 2 years at Vic College, and then it was time for him to finish it. The Vic College was not a degree-granting university. So he finished his BA at UBC, graduating class of 49.
Were the Victoria College years, were they also part of the veterans, the return veterans plan?
Oh, yes. Well, yeah. In fact, you know, if you go to Craig Derrick Castle, where Victoria College was, you see there's graffiti, including Pierre Burton, one of the students up there who carved his name in the wood. It's funny, my sister is now a director, is for many years on the board of Craig Derrick Castle, which is now a heritage site in Victoria. So it's sort of come full circle because my sister is now living in Victoria again. But, the other thing too, when my father went to law school, they allowed the veterans to article between first and second year and second and third year. So they were able to get articling credit for summer jobs that they had in law firms. So that when he graduated, I think he just had to article another 4 months and he could get called to the bar. And that was actually quite a good thing. And, you know, people are talking about where the law school is too long. You know, even doing something like that, where law students would have instant practical application of what they're doing, might well be a better way, not only of making better use of the years of study, because I think when you've had some experience with actual applying the law, you have a better idea of what you need to know and how you need to think about what you need to know. But it was a great way because that year after you graduate, you know, for many people that you know they need to pay off loans and whatever. And in those days, I mean, the veterans were eager to get into the workforce. It was actually quite a sensible thing to do. So my dad was able to get called in the fall after he graduated from law school.
But it was only veterans who had that.
Well, I think so. I think it was a program. Now, I don't know if it applied to everybody who happened to be in those classes, but it was certainly brought in for the veterans and then phased out again after the veterans were gone.
I've talked to men from that era who worked in logging camps in the summers, fishing, in the resource industries. So obviously, but it was a boom time.
Yeah.
But he chose the path of practicality in the summers and.
He had worked in those kinds of jobs before he went to law school. And the year between arts and law, you know, he had worked, he had a lot of different jobs. He worked in the fisheries, he worked in, he would have more than one job. It was like the students in those days. He had a wife and two little kids. My mother also worked. But, you know, they're just, you took student jobs. So he did a lot of that kind of thing. I don't know if he ever worked in the forest industry. The summer that I was conceived, which would have been the summer of 1946, my parents worked as forest lookouts in the Alberni Forest. I always say I was probably conceived in a forest lookout.
That's romantic.
My sister was a little tyke, and if you look at my mother's diaries of those days, it was a very sweet and romantic thing, and particularly for a couple who had been separated by the war, you know, it was very hard for people to reestablish relationships. Now, my parents did eventually get divorced, so one could say that it wasn't definitive. But when you think about it, you know, having that kind of a summer together, doing important work, because the farm coat work was, they lived up, excuse me, in this little lookout tower.
Yeah.
But it was a wonderful way to be close to nature and to have some time together to get sort of reacquainted. And as I say, I think I was conceived that summer since I was born the following March. So if you do the math, that seems about right.
Well, you bet, and it's pre-helicopter, so you hear stories of pack trains and carrying on all the provisions for months, tea and rice and oats, and sounds...
But my mother was young and adventuresome, and she loved nature because her father had been, you know, a real British Columbian, right? You know, as I say, he built the fish ladders in Sprott Lake. He was a conservationist, and you know, and he hunted every year. He would, you know, get a deer, and my grandmother would tin the venison, and put it up in jars, and she would talk about how when you preserve it, it makes its own gravy and the thing, and then you make wonderful venison pie with it. And
that's a real Depression era skill.
Yeah,
because it was.
I once had something similar visiting First Nations, where I had moose meat that had been preserved the same way. And again, it makes its own gravy as you process it. The juices all form and cook, and so that when you take it out, you just spoon it over, heat it up, and spoon it over rice, and it's quite wonderful. The flavor is excellent. So my mother was raised on game, because my grandfather was a hunter and a fisher. But he, as I say, he was also a kind of a environmentalist, conservationist, somebody who was very interested in the balance of nature. And they lived up, you know, near Cathedral Grove, in that beautiful area.
Where did, in Port Alberni, did they live?
They lived on the hill. I don't know, somebody could tell you. I don't know the name of the
probably
street.
The hill.
But it was the hill in town, which the professional people lived on. And there was apparently a plaque on the house identifying it as my grandfather's house.
Because it was a... town with a pulp mill, big pulp mill, and then out Franklin River and those places had the logging camps, a bit like Nanaimo had the coal mines.
Yeah.
But you were on the edges of the in the professional.
Yeah, my grandfather was
in the white
collar. Yeah, he was a professional, and you know, so my grandmother had, you know, tea parties and things, and the banker's wife, and the doctor's wife. And, you know, that was the, I suppose, the upper crust of a very teeny-tiny little town.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting life.
And did your dad then have he had a long career here in Vancouver?
Yeah, my father retired from the Crown, I guess, at 65. I suppose he retired then. And, however, I think there was compulsory retirement then. Sure. But he retired, and he died at 82. He died at 82 in 2002.
So I thought, born in Port Alberni, you must have, you know, there must be a kind of from the woods of the island to the big city. But you obviously came early on. Yeah. You were.
We would go back to Qualicum. Summer, we often spent summer vacations at Qualicum. My mother loved the island, and of course, Qualicum was. In fact, years later, when my stepfather came back to Canada after having been away for a while, they built a house on the beach near Campbell River, Saratoga Beach. It was a very lovely place. So, and then when he died in 1983, my mother sold her house on the island and came back to Vancouver. So, but we always had a strong sense of island links. And even her older sister, when her husband retired, bought a house on Salt Spring Island, so they didn't live on Vancouver Island. But they also, it was the lure. Once you've done the BC coast thing, it becomes sort of part of your aesthetic that you feel at home there. So.
Mm-hmm. But Vancouver, I like to call Vancouver the biggest island on the BC coast because it's sort of hemmed in. But so you grew up here and of course, I'm interested eventually in how in your university career and the, how you got into politics and so on. But what can you say something about your school and where you lived? And
well, I mean, I'm a product of public schools. When my dad was going to university, I was too young to go to school, so my parents sent me to a little school called Cypress House School at 16th and Cypress, and that put me ahead. So we were living in Burnaby then. And then the next year I started grade 2 at Spurling Avenue School in Burnaby. And then, I think it was later that year, we moved into Vancouver, and I went to Carisdale School. So I went to Carisdale School to grade 6, and then I went to Point Grey Junior High School for grade 7. It's a high school now, but it was a junior high school, grade 7 to 9 then. And then in grade 8, I went to St. Anne's Academy in Victoria. And in grade 9, the new Prince of Wales was opening close to where we lived. And so I went to Prince of Wales for grade 9 to 12. And I was the first girl to be student council president of that school. That was some of my activities. Then I went to UBC for my bachelor's degree. And in third year, I decided I wanted to, you know, do something different. I've been kind of sliding along and very involved in student activities. So I went into honors political science. So I took 5 years to get my BA, but I got an honors BA. I decided that I needed to stop horsing around and study seriously. So I went into the honors program in political science and graduated in 1969 and had a did a year of graduate work at UBC. Because I wanted to get a Canada Council Doctoral Fellowship to go to the London School of Economics. And you had to have a year of graduate work before you could do that. So then I went to the London School of Economics to study Soviet government. That was my interest. And while I was there, I had a study grant or a travel grant to go. I spent 3 months in the Soviet Union in 1972, which was a very interesting experience. And then, but I had already met my first husband then. We were married in the fall of 1972. I did one last year at the LSE, and then we came back to Vancouver. He was a professor of mathematics at UBC, Nathan Dubinsky. And I was not able to get a job in my field. And I taught at UBC as an adjunct sessional lecturer for several years, but there were no openings in the Soviet field. And I experienced my first encounter of serious sexism because I applied for a job in Soviet government at Simon Fraser, and they didn't even send for my references. And the person who got it, it was kind of bizarre. I only had to drive across town. They could have interviewed me and said, no, we like the other guy better, but they didn't even go through those motions, so it was clear. And I was a student of a very famous scholar, one of the world's leading scholars, a man named Leonard Shapiro. So I was very frustrated because there was didn't seem much point in finishing my doctorate if I wasn't going to be able to work, and I wasn't mobile. The problem when you're out in BC, there aren't a lot of universities around that you could easily commute to. But I also kind of began to feel that maybe I wasn't cut out to be an academic, that maybe it would be more interesting to be more hands-on, but I needed to retrain. So I decided to go to law school. My sister had gone to law school late, so by this time I decided that I would like to study the law, and it was interesting. It wasn't so much that I wanted to practice law, but that I thought law would be great preparation for things that I wanted. I'd thought it maybe about public life, about politics. And my father never encouraged me to go to law school. He never discouraged me, but I mean, we didn't go because that was what our dad did. My sister had a very good career in law. She was a barrister and did personal injury law, then worked as a crown, and then became a consultant and has done a lot of really important stuff in the province in terms of legal administration, and she's got a whole other story that you should talk
about.
And
her name
is Alix Campbell.
Alix Campbell.
She's left her footprint. But I discovered when I went to law school that I really liked it and that I had a lot of hooks to hang things on. In other words, I thought a lot about rule of law issues when it came to political development and the whole thing with the Soviet Union. And, you know, when you see a society that doesn't have the rule of law, you come to have a different perspective on it. And I had taught courses in comparative politics. I had taught courses in ideologies. And so when I was studying law, there was somehow kind of a natural, I had a natural affinity to it, that I was interested in it. But not so much from the perspective of necessarily wanting to practice. But, I mean, at that time, I didn't. I mean, I thought of practicing because that's what everybody did. And in my first year, I was. I also ran for the school board in my first year of law school. So just as I was starting law school, I was elected to the school board. And so I was on the school board throughout my law school career. And, in fact, in third year, I ran as a candidate in the provincial election while I was writing my third year law school exams, which was probably a foolish thing to do. But I really enjoyed politics. I also taught half-time at Langara College while I was at law school. And for sure, I was in the top 15% of my class. And I thought, okay, so I can manage this. I had no interest in winning the gold medal, but I wanted to do well enough that I would have some choices. And I got articles in a very good firm. I went to Ladner Downs. And I think they were a bit worried because I'd run in the provincial election. But I ran in a riding where I knew I couldn't win. But I sort of to get the experience. And then I served out my last year on the school board while I was doing my articles. But I think, although I really like the firm, is a great firm. And I have nothing but good things to say about it. I thought the ethos about how to practice and give good service to clients was first rate. I've never... been sorry to be exposed to that. But I think part of the problem I had was that in a big firm, most of the students who article are people who are 25-year-old, they've been coming straight through studies. By the time I was articling, I had chaired administrative tribunals as the chairman of the school board. I had done so many other things.
You're a bit older, too.
I was older, and I just was very bored and unchallenged. I just felt frustrated. And I think, in hindsight, I would have been wiser to try to go to a smaller boutique litigation firm or something where I could have worked more closely and had more responsibility sooner. I say this without any criticism at all of the firm, but it wasn't the best fit for me. And my sister had tried to warn me, but, you know, these positions were highly valued. And so, I mean, there are many ways in which I'm still very glad. In fact, I go to my old firm whenever I need legal services because I have such confidence in them. I suppose that's the best compliment I can give them.
And you grew up in that long era of the Bennett era, Wacky Bennett Senior, which went from about the late 40s to 1972. Was that a powerful influence?
No, I was totally uninvolved in politics. Nobody in my family was a politician. And, of course, I had lived for 3 years in London, so I was way... I mean, I was interested in governance, but I wasn't involved in local politics. It's interesting. I had thought about going into politics. In fact, when I was teaching political science at UBC, one of my students was the president of the Young Conservatives. And he had given me some of Robert Stanfield's speeches. He went on to get his PhD from Harvard and become a very distinguished academic in Canada. But I said to him, you know, I've thought of going into politics, but I'm not involved in a political party. He said, if you want to go into politics, don't get involved in a party. Become a star. And that was very interesting, because what he meant was, if you get involved in politics, nobody's going to reward you for being the person who, you know, organizes the campaign and runs things, that you need to be somebody that people think can get elected. And in a sense, my school board experience was helpful in giving me a public profile. And my first husband had been elected to the school board, and his colleagues wanted to run for city council after he'd served 3 terms on the school board. And his colleagues came to me and asked if I would consider running for the school board. And I said, well, you know, it's interesting. Now that I'm teaching the products of the school system, I have some perspective on, you know, how well I think they are or not prepared for what they confront when they come into my class. But I insisted on running under my own name, and they said, oh, no, you must use your married name, which was Divinsky, because your husband, you know, if you use your married name, you'd be elected for sure. And I said, but I don't use my married name professionally. I never have. And I don't want to do that. So we both ran. He ran for city council. I ran for school board. We both got elected, but I got more votes than he did. So Anyway, that worked out anyway, but that marriage came to an end. But when I was elected to the school board, I discovered that I really enjoyed public life. I enjoyed public policy. I found it very interesting.
What do trustees do?
Well, you do everything because that's why municipal governments are great places to learn how to be a politician. Because you do budgets, you do labor relations, you do policy, curriculum changes, managing of the physical plant, the seismic loading. I mean, every issue that comes up in a school district. City council you deal with potholes, but those kinds of things. But you do everything at that level of government. And you don't go someplace else to serve your constituents. I mean, every second meeting we had was in a school. So every second school board meeting, so once a month we were in, because the school board met every other week. We had committee meetings, the alternate weeks, and then every second week there was a board meeting. And our meetings were always open. We always had delegations and things. But every second meeting was in the school gymnasium somewhere. And depending on the issue, it could be full of people yelling at you, because, in teachers' unions and whatever. So, I mean, it was a very good way to teach you that politics is not an abstract exercise. Real flesh and blood human beings are affected by what you do, and they have opinions. And you can avoid a lot of mistakes if you actually take the trouble to listen to them. I mean, the openness of municipal government was very good, the fact that you had delegations, the fact that you went out and heard firsthand from people who would be affected by your decisions was actually very healthy, and it was a modus operandi that I kept with me through all three levels of government, because in addition to being the first woman to be Prime Minister of Canada, I was the first Prime Minister born and raised in British Columbia, and the first to have held elected office at all three levels of government. And it really did influence the way I thought about things.
So you got to cut your teeth in politics
at the same time, being a law student, I mean, being a lawyer was very, very interesting, but I was working with the law in a way. And so I loved being a lawyer. I didn't enjoy the practice of law. And interestingly enough, politics gave me a way of using what I knew in a very special way. When I was a member of the legislature, I chaired the legislative committee on justice and legal affairs. We went around the province doing hearings on amending the Builders' Lien Act. Oh, you might say Builders' Lien Act, oh, it's not exactly earth-shaking. Well, it's actually awfully important. When you go around the province and you meet with people in the construction trades for whom the Builders' Lien Act and how it functions is one of their most important protections. And I learned when I would go and talk to people, you'd go into these little communities and we'd be having a hearing on the act to find out what people thought. And I discovered that most people who'd be terrified, the saying is, or sort of the conventional wisdom is, that public speaking is the thing that most people are most scared of, except for people like me who love doing it. But you'd meet people who had never spoken in public before, but people are always articulate when they're talking about what they know. So these people would come and you'd ask them questions, and they would tell you the most interesting things and give you such a clear picture of how this regime worked for them, or what they thought was wrong with it, what they thought it would be better, what certain changes would mean for them. So, being a lawyer was really important to me in terms of what I was doing, because politics is about, the mechanism through which you consolidate public policy is through the law, through legislation. And so I loved being a lawyer, and my education, and of course I was at law school right when the Charter of Rights and Freedoms came in. In fact, I delayed taking my charter course until my last year of law school so that I could get the most up-to-date thinking on, because they had just the equality provisions. I mean, the charter came in 82 and the equality provisions came in 83, and there was very little jurisprudence, so we were kind of learning about it kind of in the anticipatory future. But I wanted to maximize it. That's my generation, that I was sort of the first generation that even got a chance to even talk about these provisions in any kind of concrete way with anything happening. It was the class of 83 when I graduated. So it was a really integral part of my way of thinking and my life, but I didn't want it necessarily practiced. So after I was called to the bar, I practiced for about 16 months after my call, and then I got invited to go and work as the executive director of Premier Bennett's office, because I had done my kamikaze run in Vancouver Centre with Philip Owen, the two of us had done them, so two-member constituency. And we had done wonderfully, but not well. So they, but I had come to the notice of the people in the, in that time, the Social Credit Party, as it was in those days, which was the umbrella party that enabled federal conservatives and liberals to work in the same party provincially. Because if they didn't, then the NDP would always get in. That was the way British Columbia politics were. So I went to work for Premier Bennett. It's the only time I've ever worked as a political staffer, and I also came to the conclusion that that wasn't... I like to be the hands-on politician. But it was interesting, and one of the things that I was asked to do was to review our policy towards comprehensive land claims. Because after the Calder decision, things had kind of ran to a halt. Nothing was happening. But the lack of certainty with respect to Aboriginal rights in terms of lands, and again, with the patriation of the Constitution and the constitutionalization of Aboriginal rights, that without any explanation of what they were, this created a lot of difficulties, particularly in British Columbia with its resource-based and land-based economy. So I was asked to review this, and I did a review of all of this. And before I could sort of make my recommendations to the Premier, he decided he was going to resign, and there was good, now there was a leadership campaign. And I actually ran for the leadership of the Social Credit Party, not expecting to win, which I didn't, but it gave me a chance to... My speech was broadcast in prime time at the convention, because I was the second, the third to the last speaker, and they were the second to last speaker before Bill Vanderzam, or Breiser than Bill Vanderzam after me, I think. But anyway, but I was covered in prime time, so that raised my profile. So when an election was called, I ran for the nomination in Vancouver and Point Grey, and succeeded in getting a nomination, and won a seat. There was a two-member riding, and I and Darnie Marzari won. I ran with Pat McGeer, and but he was not elected. So that got me into the provincial legislature, where I did not get on with my leader, Bill Vanderzam, since I had made the famous comment, charisma without substance is a dangerous thing, in the course of the leadership campaign. So I wasn't in his cabinet, but I had was given... other responsibilities. I chaired a task force called Project Pride on heritage conservation. We had no laws in the province at the time about heritage conservation, which is an interesting issue because it puts sort of the property rights of individual property owners against a community's right to preserve its heritage. And it's, you know, it's a difficult issue. And the I actually wrote the report. I had a very interesting task force under the auspices of the Minister of Tourism, was Bill Reid at the time. And our report then, when our government was out of power, became the basis of a white paper that the NDP brought in, became the basis of the first legislation on heritage conservation of the province. So that was great, I felt. And there are still people around who remember that. I occasionally went into an architect or somebody who remembers that I did that. And also, I chaired the Justice and Legal Affairs Committee. So we did the work on the Builders Lien Act, and we did a review of provincial judges' salaries. I mean, there were several things that... So I got to do some substantive study when I wasn't in the cabinet.
And this was...
In 1986, I was elected to the legislature.
86 to 88, yeah. You were MLA.
So in 88, I attended a meeting of the Union of BC Municipalities that was being held in Whistler, and they, it was the run-up to the 88 election, federal election, and I heard John Turner speak, and he was talking about the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, and I had followed this because when I worked for Premier Bennett, he was involved in the discussions about the negotiation of the FTA, and from British Columbia's view, and I was of the view that it was probably a pretty valuable thing for British Columbia, and it was something that, you know, that Premier Bennett had supported, and I kind of agreed with his view. I liked Bill Bennett very much, as a matter of fact. You know, he kind of left under a bit of a cloud. I think I don't think he ever did anything. I think people around him got into trouble, but he was actually a very good guy and always incredibly nice to me. It wasn't his father, but he was kind of a solid guy, I think. I liked him. And he always treated me with great kindness. But anyway, and in the conversations I had, I mean, I tended to think that the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement was going to be important, and I was concerned because John Turner was pushing a lot of buttons and getting people very concerned and was very persuasive, and I thought he was wrong. So I thought at the time, that was in September, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I should, you know, give a speech or two or get myself involved in a campaign. And then Pat Carney had decided he wasn't going to run at Vancouver Centre. They didn't have a candidate, and they didn't have a candidate, and I'd been approached, and I thought, no, I don't want to do this. And finally, it became clear that I probably wasn't going to be able to accomplish much more as an MLA, that I didn't get on with the premier. I spoke to my then husband at the time, my second husband, and his family. He was divorced, and his children from his first marriage lived in the East, in Hull. So all things considered, we decided to go for it. So I was 3 weeks into the campaign when I got the nomination, and just managed to get across the finish line. I mean, my votes were going up. I mean, if the election had been a week later, I'd have had an even more substantial margin, but I managed to just get there in time. And so I was elected to Parliament. And so our first hearings, sittings of Parliament, involved passing the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement legislation. And then in January, I was appointed to Cabinet as the Minister of State for Indian Affairs and Northern Development. Guess what? All of that work I did for Premier Bennett on comprehensive land claims, I packed it along with me. I was the first British Columbian to be in that portfolio since Art Lang in the 1960s. So I was the junior minister. Pierre Cardieu, the senior minister, said he was going to take the North, and he said, you should take anything you want to do in BC, and he gave me some other issues to do nationally. So I met with the people in the department, and I said, we have to start, you know, get the land claims negotiations going again, because my conclusion had been was that it was in the federal government's court, that this was, it was their jurisdiction, and they really needed to get it going. That, you know, British Columbia needed to be a willing partner, but that they couldn't really initiate it. And one of them said, well, you know, it's, and, you know, it'll disproportionately, you know, benefit British Columbia. And I said, well, you know, we do a lot of things that disproportionately benefit one part of the country over the other. You know, the last time I looked, British Columbia was part of Canada. We're going to do this. And so after I took my teeth out of his ankle, they got busy and started the process. And a year later, when I became Minister of Justice, Tom Sidden was made Minister of Indian Affairs. And I was the political minister for British Columbia. So we kept working on it. And the comprehensive land claims process is a direct result of the work I did for Premier Bennett and the initiatives that I made as the junior minister for Indian Affairs, and was able to follow through as political minister of British Columbia. But again, being a lawyer made a big difference to that, because, and my second husband had worked for the Attorney General of British Columbia and knew a lot about these issues. I mean, they were legally very complex and interesting, and the concepts, and I think if I hadn't been a lawyer, I might not have had the same affinity and interest in the issues or ability to get my head around them. So there I am, being a lawyer, being a lawyer of public policy.
Could I ask about some of your...
Let's get the porcelain water.
Yes.
Oh, we do it great.
We've got about 2 hours on the tape, so we're... I was going to ask about your... The professors at law school and the colleagues, before we get too far ahead, who do you remember who was really influential, and what courses?
Well, I had lots of great professors. This may seem funny to you. The one maybe who inspired me the most was George Curtis. George Curtis had taught my father. He had been, I think, the founding dean of the law school and gone off to create the law school at the University of Calgary. And when I was in third year, I took a course in secured transactions from George Curtis. You know, secured transactions is not the most romantic area of the law. Very good, very fundamental. You need to know that. You need to know how to live yourself if you ever want to have a mortgage or you get yourself into debt. You better know about the law. But you know what I loved about it was he was such a joyful teacher. And he used to say to me, after, you know, you used to ask really good questions. Well, I used to ask good questions because I really liked the class. He loved the law. And he could teach you a course in secured transactions and make you love the law, too. And the sense of how the law can work, you know, to make our lives better. That's what law is about. Law is about making rules that we can live by. Law is a way of letting people who don't know each other build, have trust, enter into transactions, protect themselves, you know, determine what's going to happen with their estate after they're gone. The law is a wonderful, wonderful mechanism. And to live in a country, to grow up in a country with the rule of law is one of the great privileges. I always say I won the global lottery in being born in Canada. You know, a country with the rule of law. And the law changes. You know, sometimes the law is an ass, and sometimes we get it wrong. But the great thing about democracy is you can fix your mistakes. So the combination, I mean, why the rule of law is essential to democracy. Elections aren't sufficient for democracy, but elections are one of the tools that enable you to fix the mistakes that you make by throwing guys out and bringing new guys in, or even making new mistakes and saying, oops, we better bring them in.
And had you seen the opposite in the Soviet Union?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'd seen it. I'd seen what it does to people when all of their social relations are totally personal, in the sense, like, how can I get that person behind the counter to do what I need to do? You know, and how can I live with the frustrations of a country where the customer is always wrong? You know, and where you have no rights. I mean, the Soviet Constitution, people say, oh, it's such a great constitution because it had all these rights. Then there was a little catch 22: citizens shall enjoy the exercise of their rights in exchange for the performance of their duties. Hello. And the other one that said that the party is the leading organ of all of social life. I forget the actual words now. So those were the two provisions of the Soviet Constitution. It wasn't even hidden. It was right there. The party is the leader of everything. You don't get to do anything unless the party approves. And you don't have any rights unless you perform your duties. And we'll decide what your duties are. Because the party is the leading organ. So anything that you do that goes against the party is clearly performing your duties. So the point is that you know what the rule of law really means in a country with the rule of law is something totally different. As I say to my students, you know, or people that I talk to, the rule of law, I do a lot of work around the world now in democracy promotion and helping people who are building their democracies. The rule of law doesn't just mean you have laws. Lots of countries have laws. The rule of law means that they apply to everybody. They constrain everybody, including the people who make them. That's the key. You know, I could make gazillions of laws, like in Soviet Union, a wonderful constitution. You know, but it doesn't constrain the people who are making the law. So, ergo, no rule of law. So, as I had lots of wonderful teachers at UBC Law School, and it's partly because I'm demented that I can't remember the names of all of them. If I looked at the list, I could go, yeah, he taught me. They were great people. But George Curtis, who was by that time in his 80s, there was just something about the example of somebody doing what he loved. And I mean, he loved everything about it. I mean, they used to joke that, you know, fiat justitia ruit coelum, coelum over the doormat, the dean is out, please leave a message. But, you know, at that time in Doonesbury, you know, Joni Caucus was going to law school, and she had this law school class that he used to run. I was like, oh my God, I love the law. And George Curtis was a little bit like that, but in the nicest way. My first husband used to say the same thing. He was a mathematics professor, and people used to kill to get into his class because he was a wonderful teacher. But he also said he felt that one of his duties was to communicate to students the joy that comes from using your mind. That it's, you know, that he was happy and he made jokes, and you know, he didn't tell jokes, he just made jokes. And I taught that way too. I was known as being very, very funny. I can't tell a joke, but you just sort of, you see the humor and things, whatever. It's a very good pedagogical device. And it is this way of communicating the pleasure that comes from thinking seriously about things. And for George Curtis, it was the pleasure of kind of, isn't this neat the way the law works here? And isn't this interesting how, you know, you have this problem or that problem? And here's an issue, and here's what you need to know. And this is, you know. It just was a wonderful kind of example of what a life in the law can mean for somebody. You know, and it was great, the fact that I knew he taught my father. You know, he went back and he loved that. I mean, this was for him, you know, that it was, he loved that sense of history. And he was a very dear man. So I had lots of really great teachers, people who were really superb in their field. I can't remember any that I had that were. Was a guy who taught us. I can picture them, have to go back and look at the list and tell you who they were.
That's fine. You've got had lots of names to remember.
Beverly McLaughlin was my contracts professor in first year, I just had lunch with her a few weeks ago. She was a wonderful professor. And then in third year, when she was already on the bench, because she was called the day of our last class in contracts in first year, she taught an advanced evidence course, and I took that from her as well. She was on the bench. She taught as a teacher. She was a very good teacher. I liked her very much.
We'd like to talk to her for this project.
Yeah,
I'm,
she's
I
a
might,
target.
I might send
she has
you a
condo
note.
In Vancouver. So now she's 70, and she'll be Chief Justice till she's 75. But depending on how much time you have, she does have a condo here, so she's likely to come out here for a lot of her retirement.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
But she's great, yeah.
And the other students?
They were great. A mixed bag. I still see some. Some of them. I was older than many of them, not the most. I just saw Sandy Garasino at the breakfast with the Prime Minister this morning. She was she was in my class. My claim to fame when I was in law school was that for 3 years I wrote and directed the Law Review, R-E-V-U-E. I didn't write all of it. I got inveigled when I was in first year because the guy who'd done it for the last 2 years was tired of doing it. And I'm one of these people who has a tendency to come in and do something when nobody else will do it. So I ran to the Vancouver Center, they didn't have a candidate, but this is ridiculous. Anyway, so... I went to the meeting about the Law Review, and they said, we need somebody to direct it. And nobody else volunteered, and I knew nothing about directing, but when I was in graduate school, I spent every spare penny I had going to the theater, and I was a huge theater buff. And my husband and I used to do a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta every year. So I said, okay, I'll do it. And the way the Law Review was, the first half was skits, so you had to audition people to do skits, and then the second half was kind of like a little musical comedy. And I partnered up with a woman who at that time called herself June Forrester. She changed her name to Maggie. She's now a teacher. But she and I were sort of the Rodgers and Hammerstein of the law school. Except that we both did. I wrote the script, and we would divvy up the lyrics. So the first year, it was called West Coast Story, and it was sort of a takeoff on West Side Story about big downtown law firms and storefront law firms, and it was a lot of political satire about civic politics, with Harry Rankin and Mike Harcourt and Jack Vorage and all this kind of stuff. And I did the choreography, and I did it all. Then the band said, we want to play the Muppet theme. So that year they wanted to play the Muppet theme. We want to play the Muppet theme and we can't find band parts. Can you help us get band parts? So I said, give me a piano score. And I got a piano score and I wrote band parts for them. So I didn't know I could do that. And then the second year, our musical was called How to Succeed in Law School Without Really Trying. Which is this kid, and it was all very political. We had Trudeau come in. We had a very funny, the opening course was all the reasons why people go to law school that are not the traditional reasons, there comes a day you find you have a BA, and you don't care for law school. That's when you learn that you're in no shape to learn. Where do you go from there? Law school. And Jim Coutts, who had just lost his election, Jim Coutts had just died. He was one of the characters. He said, if you want to get away, there's no place that is fine, especially when you've just had your ass kicked in Spadina. when your career turns out to be rather dreary, you can always try law school, teacher orders when things go from bad to worse. Just kiss it all goodbye for law school. If your job is lousy and but ambitions don't forsake you, and you're over 30 so the med school will not take you, come right on in. Your future could still be gold because it's never too late and you're never too old to try law school. That's where we're headed, to law school, to be retreaded at law school where there's a new life for you. Anyway.
It's the Petulia Clark downtown.
We took all these things. And so that was second year. Then third year, because now the charter had come in, it was called Best Little Courthouse in Canada. And the theme was that the judges of the Supreme Court of Canada are totally stymied. They don't know what to do because they've got this charter of rights. So the two judges from the U.S. Supreme Court come up to share ideas, and it's Warren Burger and Sandra Day O'Connor. Mm-hmm. And I played Sandra Day O'Connor, and June played Bertha Wilson. So we wrote ourselves good roles in these last two. Mm-hmm. We always played a role in these things. And it was very funny. And the street solicitation challenge laws were being challenged. That was going up to the Supreme Court of Canada. So we had a wonderful chorus where the judges were singing, like you just said, the last question, we're reviewing the situation. Here's a traffic bylaw that we're dealing with, but it's blatant discrimination, makes it criminal injustice and in pith. The bylaw says you may consort on streets to talk of news or sport, but conversation that reflects a wish to sell or purchase sex. The bylaw breaches this, we fear, intrudes upon the federal sphere, and so on this we all agree, it's ultra vires Calgary. We think we need to get through again. Sort of from Oliver, the Fagin song. Oliver. Anyway, that was my what people knew about me from law school was that I wrote and directed the law school for the Law Review for 3 years.
Where did you perform?
We recorded in the sub ballroom. There are some videos. I actually took some video. There is some in the UBC library that my father had taken. And the last year, I have a DVD, but when I went to my law school reunion, the last one we had, I gave everybody copies of the DVD I had it made. And I don't have, my dad took them for all 3 years, but I only had the last one. But anyway, that was a lot of fun. Mm. And then we had, the first half was skits. And one of my classmates was, Brent Tynan. And he was a brilliant impressionist mimic. And for 3 years, I begged him to come into the Law Review. And finally, in third year, he did the Law Review and did some skits. And he was so funny. He could just, he did a Joe Clark that was better than Joe Clark. I mean, he was just incredibly humorous. Did some wonderful skits. He's playing Joe Clark, and he's wearing his little mitts. Because then when I went to Parliament and I'm sitting around the table with all these people I'd sent up in the Law Review, and it was a major deal. Mm-hmm. We had Joe Clark with a little mittens pinned to his to his sleeve, and he's reading the paper, and he goes, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, what will that Nancy and Sluggo get up to next?" Well, I guess they had a few more this year. He was a comedic genius. And like me, doesn't practice law. I'm one of the best students in our class didn't practice law. But anyway, so that's what I was known about. But again, what was fun for me was writing political and legal satire. Mm-hmm. Taking the Supreme Court of Canada decision on the Calgary Student Solicitation Bylaw, putting it to music. It was actually pretty good because it was actually exactly what they said in the judgment. Mm-hmm. Pretty clever. I do say so myself. Mm-hmm. And then again, years later, when the law school was celebrating its 50th anniversary, was it? Must have been
95. Would have been
no, I think, no, 98.
Right.
Because 48 was the first call. And I was asked, they brought people to speak on the different decades of the law school, and I was asked to speak for the students of the 80s. Mm-hmm. I think at that time, So I used the themes of the Law Review to express the kinds of things that were the preoccupation of students, because that's really what they were. Mm-hmm. And I sang some of the little ditties. Chief Justice LaMere was there. Got into it. Anyway.
Well, I get the sense from Dean Curtis, and also from your memories of passion for law and for your education and career. And I'm not sure what the time is, but
maybe I was just taking the opportunity to see whether I have any response.
Maybe we have a bit of time. I've got you down here as 88 to 93. MP.
Yeah.
And what? So what happened?
Well,
that was a very fast trajectory.
Well, it wasn't such a fast trajectory because, first of all, I'd held elected office before. Pierre Trudeau served 1 year as a parliamentary secretary Sorry, right. 1 year as a parliamentary secretary, 1 year as Minister of Justice, and then was elected leader of the party. I served almost 5 years as a minister before I was elected leader of the party. Of the 18 men who preceded me as prime minister, only 8 had more cabinet experience than I had. So everybody said, oh, it's because when you're a woman, people don't think you belong. They said, well, that was rapid. Well, it was, Pierre Trudeau was much more rapid than mine was.
And you had this experience MLA and with the school board.
Yeah, and I had held elected office before. So, but when you're a girl, you have to do it twice. As Charlotte Whitten said, a woman has to be twice as good as a man in order to be thought half as good, but fortunately that's easy. Anyway, but then after my year as Minister of State for Indian Affairs and Northern Development, where I got kickstarted the comprehensive land claims process. And I was also, it's interesting. I see, really how my modus operandi from local and provincial politics stayed with me because, I was the first minister in Indian Affairs to actually bring all of the, quote, Indian agents, that are local representatives, to a meeting. I brought people together in Vancouver, all the British Columbia-based officials, to talk about, what do you think we need to do here? If you had your druthers, if you could make policy. Some of them were old, kind of condescending days, but others were bright-eyed, bushy-tailed people who, they'd never had a chance to speak to their minister. I want to go talk to people. You're the people on the ground. What do you think?
So you've done this in the school board
and locally. And I discovered that if you talk to them, you don't necessarily agree with them. And yes, you have people who have their own axe to grind. But it's amazing how many errors you can avoid if you actually listen to people. Because things have been tried. Or things that people who are on the ground struggle, and sometimes they're even just grateful that somebody cares enough to listen to what their views are. And what challenges they're facing and how things are difficult. So anyway, I was out in British Columbia, and I was going to be giving some speeches on the budget. This was February of 1990. I was elected in November of 88, went into cabinet January of 89. February of 90, I'm in Vancouver, I've come out, and it's hard, going back and forth, Vancouver and Ottawa. You can never serve your constituents the same way somebody who lives an easy commuting distance of Ottawa, if you're from Montreal or Toronto or Kingston or whatever. It's so much easier for you. Even Halifax, because my colleague Peter McCreesy said, I could get on the plane at 9 in the morning in Halifax and be in Ottawa for a 9:30 meeting.
Because you're flying in the other direction. Yeah. Right.
So, just totally different. And when you're coming back and forth between Vancouver and Ottawa, very exhausting. And in those days, there was not a direct flight between Vancouver and Ottawa, you could imagine. You had to go through Calgary. Or Toronto. If you could imagine. It was a direct flight. So, I get a call from Stanley Hart, who's the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. He says, the Prime Minister would like you in Ottawa Thursday morning. And I said, but I'm scheduled to speak to the Board of Trade about the preamble of the budget or Lake or something. These speeches scheduled, we were told to go out and talk about it. He said, the Prime Minister would like to meet with you in Ottawa Thursday morning. And what is more, you will be so happy, rocks will melt in your mouth. So I said, I think there's going to be a cabinet shuffle. So I said, jawohl, mein Führer, and prepared to go back. And I got back to Ottawa, and my chief of staff, who was my EA, I was only a junior minister, that's what I'm saying. And I had alerted him, and we knew there was bound to be a cabinet shuffle. We couldn't figure out where I was going to be going. And we concluded that maybe it was going to be Solicitor General. So he went to the library, and he got out stuff about Justice Minister and Solicitor General. The Justice Minister was just cover, and we threw that away, and we went to Solicitor General. So no idea where I was going to be shifted. So I go to the Prime Minister's office. And the first time I went, I almost missed my first time. Anyway, this time I went, and my driver could tell me who the other cars were that were parked in front of 24 Sussex Drive. And I was taken in, moved into the sunroom, so you're not supposed to see anybody else. It was all very close to me. So I'm waiting and waiting and waiting. And finally, the Prime Minister comes in, and he says, "Kim, we'll have to talk in the car because there's a vote in the house. We've got to get back to the house." So we go and we get in the car, and we're driving through Ottawa. And he said, I'm having a cab for myself tomorrow. And Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada and political minister for British Columbia. And I said, I'm gonna go, yeah. It's like, whoa, wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we get to the apartment buildings, and I'm driving up with the Prime Minister, so we can't alert the media. So he gets out, and I get out, and I walk around, and I go into the house, and I do whatever vote we're doing. I go out, and my EA is there, and we go and walk down the hall, get into the elevator to go over to the West Block where my office is. And there's somebody else in the elevator, and I say, Minister of Justice, Attorney General of Canada, political minister for British Columbia. And we go, in the elevator going like this. Then the doors open and we walk over. And my senior staffer from Vancouver flew down. She said, I don't want to miss this. So she was there. So it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. I was the first woman to be Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada. Mm-hmm. And it was just a huge honor. And I'm wearing my big green down coat as we go to Rideau Hall. And there was a picture taken of me outside of Rideau Hall with the snow gun, and I'm wearing this down coat and I'm smiling. It was on the front page of the Ottawa Citizen, and my deputy minister and his staff got the picture and had it framed, the picture on the front page, and had it framed for me, and I still have it somewhere because it just, they said, you know, when things are getting down, remind yourself of how happy you felt that day. But I was just thrilled, and I had an unbelievably wonderful deputy, John Tate, who since died. It's really sad. And it was funny, he and I got on so well that there were people who thought, really very stupidly, didn't know him, that maybe we were having an affair. And if you knew John Tate, I mean, never, ever, 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 ever. I mean, he was very happy to meet him. He was such a straight arrow. But we adored each other because neither of us wanted to do the other's job. And he was really thrilled that I had a vision for being Justice Minister. Mm. You know, I met with him the first Saturday after I was sworn in. Well, actually, Doug Lewis, who was my predecessor, brought Don to the swearing-in and said, I want you to meet the best deputy in Ottawa. And he was really wonderful. And the following Saturday, it was the only time I ever asked the staff to work on the Saturday. We came in Saturday morning with Michael Farabee, who was my EA. And Michael had already said, I don't have the experience to be the chief of staff to a minister of justice, so we have to find you a new chief of staff. But we sat down, and I said, hey, I want to talk about what the themes are that I want to pursue as minister of justice. The first one is inclusive justice. I'm the first woman to be Minister of Justice, and I want to look at the issues of women in the law and Aboriginal people in the law. So women and Aboriginal people as a part of inclusive justice. Mm. The secondly, public security, public safety. And of course, by this time, Mark Lapine had gone into École Polytechnique, and one of the first things I did was go to École Polytechnique because my predecessor had begun to review our gun control legislation after that. It had been years since any change had been made to it, so I knew I needed to look at that issue. And third was what I called fairness in the relations between citizens and government, issues of administrative law that I wanted to look at. And what I discovered is that, you know, public servants will give you wonderful service if you give them leadership, if you tell them what you want. Mm-hmm. And John was so thrilled that I had my sort of three priorities that I figured out what I wanted to do. He thought they were the right ones. Mm-hmm. And that meant that he could go into action with the department. And he loved the fact that I like to sit down and meet with the lawyers who were working hands-on on a file. So, for example, when we were doing amendments to the Human Rights Act, some of the people who were getting were kind of discouraged because I hadn't taken it forward and I hadn't taken it forward. And I said to them, I can only take one really controversial issue in Parliament at a time. If I take this in now, it will fail. But as soon as the gun control legislation passes, you better be ready, because I'm going to move on. Mm. You know, and it was really important to share with people. You know, I wasn't politicizing them; I was making them part of a political process. But how could they serve me if they didn't understand, or if they thought I wasn't going to do something? Mm. But they had to understand what I was dealing with. you know, wasn't that we had now had good reasons for legislation. This stuff is really controversial. It dealt with sexual orientation and reasonable accommodation, both of which were very difficult issues. And, you know, I can't fight this battle while I'm fighting gun control. You know, we've got to win the gun control, we've got to get the bill passed. Then we bring in another toughie. And so John was just a great, great deputy. And as I say, he didn't want to do my job, I didn't want to do his job. And it just was wonderful. Mm-hmm. We had a great, great, great relationship and really passed a record amount of legislation in the 3 years that I was Minister of Justice. And I think being Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada is lawyer heaven. I think it's the most fun you can have as a lawyer, because you're making the law, you're thinking broadly and creatively about it, and you've got a cast of thousands that do all the boring bits. You know, you've got all these good people who do the tough part for you, and you can think the great thoughts. Now, I will also say that Brian Mulroney was a great prime minister to work for. That he, when he knew that I could deal with tough issues and not tear the caucus apart, because in other times, you know, he'd had, you know, caucus members sitting in his office demanding that he get rid of the justice minister. Because it's difficult issues you're dealing with. I mean, the criminal law powers bring you into all sorts of areas. You know, I dealt with abortion, gun control, gay rights, you know. Not such simple issues. But I worked really well with my colleagues and treated them with respect and always tried to... I never made an enemy out of anybody. And when I declared for the leadership, I mean, all of these dinosaurs, you know, the people who were totally against everything, I called them dinosaurs because they were really... It's not fair. Scratch that from the record. But people who were 180 degrees opposed to me were standing up and saying, I'm supporting Kim because she's tough, but she's fair. You know, I didn't make an enemy. I didn't say I'm Justice Minister, so I get to impose my views. But when you've lost the argument, it doesn't mean that I don't respect you for making the argument. That's what you were elected to do. And your constituents, you know, have a different view on this. And they've lost this argument. But not because their member of parliament didn't do his or her job. And I would go out to their ridings and tell people that. And say, you know, I'm sure, you know, you don't like my gun control legislation, but your member of parliament struggled a lot against it. She didn't win the argument. And you and I will have to agree to disagree. But you were well served by your MP. And,
what was the structure of the Ministry of Justice? Was it federal, obviously, but did it look like across the country?
Well, the basic way the ministry worked in Ottawa was you have the minister's office that sets the leadership and the minister's political staff. And then you have the public service. And the minister's political staff worked with people, the directors and leaders of the department. And my people always worked with great respect. I mean, we had a right to set the agenda. We were the elected, accountable people. But we worked really well. And it's interesting because people who worked with me then on my staff say that some of them have kept relationships with the people they had more than 20 years ago in justice. And they say that people in the Justice Department still describe it as a golden age, because it was very clear what the department was about, that we governed in the interests of the national interest. And so I feel very good about that. Yeah. Having the respect of people who worked with me in the Justice Department is important to me. But then there were offices across the country that were just fonctionnaire, that there was no political presence there. They were the ones who would deliver our programs to the extent that there are programs that were delivered on a regional basis. And I, whenever I went to a city, I would try to go and meet with the local people in the local office, say hello, ask them what they're doing. But basically, the main activity happens in Ottawa, because that's where the legislation is passed, the regulations are made. But of course, the federal government had one small prosecutorial power in the area of drug laws, too. And we did justice in the territories. But I don't know if I've answered your question.
I was really thinking. You mentioned earlier that you had the kind of inclusive or consensus style of government at the local level or the provincial level, and so I was wondering how that translated to the federal level. on it, which is a much larger bureaucracy.
Well, but it wasn't just the bureaucracy. For example, when we were doing the rape shield legislation, the Supreme Court of Canada had struck down the rape shield provisions of the criminal code, and the case had made its way up through the court. We knew what was coming. We knew it was likely that the court would strike it down. They did, but they didn't strike it down. They struck it down because they thought they agreed with the principle, but they thought the statute as written was overly broad. And interestingly enough, and this was something that I was surprised at, that Beverly McLaughlin, I think, had written the reason, said that she thought that we should let the courts figure it out. And I thought, that's impossible. You cannot make jurisprudential guinea pigs out of complainants in a sexual assault case. We have to legislate. And we had done a lot of work. And we looked at, one of the things that was interesting is that criminal law is a state jurisdiction in the United States. So for a lot of these issues, we could look at what certain, you know, very good, you know, progressive, legally sophisticated states had done to draft legislation. You know, so we learned from them. And so by the time the decision came striking down rape shield, we had a pretty good sense of what we wanted to do. And it was a fairly comprehensive review of reworking of the sexual assault law. And I said I thought we needed to legislate. Now, there were a lot of women, women's groups. First of all, they were very uncomfortable with the conservative feminist. I mean, when I became justice minister, I described myself as a feminist, and there was an audible intake of breath across the country, but, you know, they got over it. I didn't know how else to describe somebody who was, an advocate for equality for women and believed in it. There were a lot of organizations who had been working on these issues, and they were worried, I think, that I was just going to put a band-aid on the law. And they thought there were a lot of other issues in the law of sexual assault that needed to be dealt with. So I had these groups coming out against my legislation before I'd even tabled anything. So we started our consultative process, and we met with all the usual suspects, you know, the bar associations, whatever. But I also broadened the consultation. We met with organizations representing women of color, organizations representing women in the sex trade. Because as women of color would say that in terms of sexual assault, you know, a lot of times police sort of think that it's a cultural issue, and they wouldn't really, you know, come after people. They would kind of not take it all that seriously, or they would assume that, you know, this was sort of a cultural value or something, which is mind-boggling. Women in the sex trade, you know, the fact that you're a prostitute doesn't mean that you consent to every sexual touching. And there was a judge in Australia who had rendered a decision saying that basically this woman was a prostitute, and she was abducted, not by a client, by somebody who raped her, beat her within an inch of her life, and left her to die. She didn't die. Somebody found her, and she lived. And the judge said that she couldn't, because she was a prostitute, she had no capacity for shame, and that there couldn't be a sexual assault. I mean, it was unbelievable, straight from the 18th century. I shouldn't say that 18th century was the Enlightenment, straight from the 19th century. Anyway, so there I was getting, you know, so we broadened our consultation. And then there was Real Women on the right who, you know. Anyway, but we talked to her. We talked to all these people. And then this group from LEAF came in. And these were the people who'd been working on this issue and were afraid that I wasn't going to do it right. And they came in and they started nagging me. And I said, well, you know, maybe I should just give you an idea of what we're thinking about before we continue the conversation, because that will help us to, you know, you can respond to things that we're thinking about doing. And I talked about some of the issues. Oh, their mouths just dropped. I mean, this was exactly what they were hoping we would do. And they couldn't believe that, you know, I as a Tory, you know, even though everybody knew I was pro-choice and all that kind of stuff, but I couldn't, you know, we couldn't possibly, you know, because people feel like they own the issue. So you have to find on the left, like, we own these issues. Well, you don't own the issues. And anyway, so to make a long story short, they were absolutely thrilled, and of course they all wanted to take credit for the bill that was tabled. And I said, I don't care who takes the credit for it; I just want to get it passed through Parliament. And actually, it was actually one of the easier bills, because a lot of the men were standing up and saying, you know, sexual assault is a terrible thing, and it's a fear that women live with, and we need to have this bill. So that was a great success. But it was interesting because after meeting with my officials, Gwen Lendl had come out against the bill. And one of my officials said, we apologize, Minister, we dropped the ball. We didn't reconnect with her after we'd had this agreement on what was going to go on the bill. And I had said to them, you know, if people think they own an issue and you don't consult with them, even if you do what they, you know, dream of having, they will attack you. Because by doing it without them, you're removing their whole validity. You're saying they don't count, they're unimportant. And frankly, even if you haven't needed their input, even if you came to the conclusion separately, they're an important part of creating the constituency to support your legislation. Mm-hmm. You need them. Mm-hmm. Maybe you came up with the good ideas without them, but you're not going to sell them without them. You need them out there feeling that they can take ownership of this and that you respect them. It's all about respect. Respect is the most important thing. And that's what John Tate used to say. He said, you know, you treat people with respect. And, you know, he just thought it was wonderful. Well, you know, it's, yeah, I do. Because, you know what, I'm a realist. I respect people because, you know what, I don't know it all. And the fact that I'm minister, yeah, I'm minister, but I'm not God. That doesn't give me the right to impose my views on people. You know, I better go out and listen and learn and try to do the best I can. And maybe I won't always get everything I want because, you know what, it's not politically doable. So anyway, but all of that previous experience gave me confidence in the process, but it also had taught me how important it is to make those alliances. And what was interesting for me with that conversation was how the officials in the department had understood that they had dropped the ball and that we were having this, that we didn't affect the passage of the legislation, but that we were having this opposition that we needn't have had if we had been, you know, more careful to validate, consult with, bring her in on the final versions. She might not have agreed with them, but we just sort of thanked her for the input and treated her with respect. So when we talk about dealing with the department, you know, it's the consultation. It's not so much with the departments, it's with the people outside, but creating a modus operandi in the department which says, you know, the fact that the minister wants to consult outside doesn't mean she doesn't like your work. It means she doesn't think we have all the brains in here. Mm-hmm. And your work is a great point of departure for going out and finding out how this will work in the real world. And chances are, you know, it'll, you know, survive pretty well unscathed. But we might learn some things that enable us to massage a point here or add something there or avoid a problem here if we go out and consult. And that was, to me, part of the my view about changing the culture of the department, about how we made laws. So, but that was a lot of it, my own. But two things. One, my own respect for the fact that when you have the law, it does affect people. Affects flesh and blood human beings, and you better be clear on how that's going to work, because there's a lot. I mean, it was like gun control. People have a lot of ridiculous ideas, and one of my successors, who shall go nameless, was constantly, you know, making these big, you know, statements. He was determined that he had, you know, our gun control, it wasn't enough for him to implement our very comprehensive gun control legislation. He had to do his own, and he said coming up with things that I knew didn't make any sense. So the department was constantly having to, you know, backfill from his, you know, impossible, the holes that he was digging himself into, you know, and it's because he was too arrogant to listen to anybody, you know, and I learned from my own errors and my own foot in the mouth and, you know, early on that, you know, it's amazing, just be quiet and listen what you can learn from people, and they can protect you from making well-intentioned but really stupid mistakes that may wind up undermining everything that you're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. So you were 3 years as Minister of Justice.
Which was kind of an ideal time because you have a year to figure out your agenda, a year to work at implementing it, and a year to kind of tidy up the loose ends and, mm-hmm. you know, get things set up for the next person. Mm-hmm. I loved being Justice Minister. But when I was made Minister of Defense, it was funny how quickly, you know, I moved. But it's interesting, you can take the girl out of the Justice Department, but when we had the the when I was Minister of Defense, and we had the atrocity in Somalia, and the murder of Shanae Narone. Mm-hmm. I remember the Canadian Airborne, and it became very clear that I had been briefed on a false document, which was really very terrible. That, and it's never been determined, because the commission that was supposed to decide that was to find out about that was strangely canceled right before they were getting to the end of the last testimony by the caretaker. But when this happened, everybody was saying, "Well, you can't do anything about it. You know, it's an issue, can't do anything about it." And I didn't believe there wasn't anything I could do about it. I needed to know if we had a systemic problem in the Department of Defense, and I knew we couldn't get interfere with criminal processes. But as the leader of the department, I needed to know if there were changes in the Department of National Defense needed to make to avoid other such things happening. And I brought in John Tate. I said, "I want the Deputy Minister of Justice here." I brought him into the Defense Department to sit at the table to help give me legal advice as to what I could do as the Minister of National Defense to respond to this problem. And basically the conclusion was that I could construct a commission of inquiry. As soon as they got into the issues that related to the criminal charges, they had to stop. But up until then, they could explore things and help me to determine what the challenges were that could be responded to right away. Because there had been a couple of Supreme Court of Canada decisions, the one on the Patty Starr case, I don't know if you remember that. There were two, where the court said you cannot use a public inquiry to do the work of the criminal law. First of all, the people of public inquiries don't have the same protection that people have in the criminal law. So there is a point where you have to stop. You can't use a public inquiry in lieu of a criminal process. Mm-hmm. So somebody there isn't enough evidence for a criminal charge, you can't put them through a public inquiry, you know, in a way that is, in a sense, denying them those kind of protections. Mm-hmm. And all the other things. So anyway, but again, and what was interesting is that it's the only time I've ever been accused of a cover-up, and it was very painful. My mother once said that the worst thing in life is to be falsely accused. Mm-hmm. Because the media could not figure out that the disconnect was between the minister's office and the rest of the department. You know, the chief of the defense staff had supposedly said to people, you know, the minister's a candidate for the leadership, and, you know, you keep your nose clean. And I thought, well, yeah, fair enough. We're all under a microscope. Don't do stupid things. Don't think you're going to be able to get away with stuff. You know, bear in mind that you've been under more scrutiny. But I never asked anybody to do anything differently because I was a candidate for the leadership. I never would have. And my staff had been with me through 3 years in justice. And they knew how their minister thought. Mm. And they knew what the bottom line was for their minister. So I never had any concerns about my own staff. And they just would never have tolerated anything. Mm. You know, because they would have known that I wouldn't tolerate it. And also, I mean, how dumb would that have been? You know, they always say that the worst things, you know, are not the mistakes people make, it's the cover-up after. Mm-hmm. But I was not in Somalia counseling them to mayhem. I mean, you know, we had somebody who committed an atrocity. And the briefing note to me said, the death of this Somali is perplexing. He had a bruise on his chest and a contusion near his mouth or vice versa. Perhaps a post-mortem will give a better explanation how he died. Then, months later, you see the trophy pictures that they took of this kid. His body is black and blue. And whoever wrote that briefing note to the Minister of National Defense was lying through their teeth. Who wrote it? I don't know who signed off. But where did that information come from? And how far up did people know? But it was the briefing note to me. And my staff were thinking, you know, oh, this guy who, you know, killed this kid, he tried to hang himself, and the only reason anybody even found out about it was because there was a reporter from Petawawa who saw them moving Clayton Matchie's body, who was the kid who killed him, into the infirmary because he tried to hang himself. And if that had not been seen, we might never have known about it. And, you know, but this notion that I was trying to cover it up, because it took 2 weeks for the truth to come out. And meanwhile, my staff are thinking, oh, this guy was, you know, he was Native Indian, and, you know, maybe he just felt so terrible, and maybe, you know, they, you know, we're thinking of sort of thin skull, and maybe this kid has some kind of problem, and you know, he got roughed up a bit and died, and then I felt so bad, and you know, boy, were we naive. We were naive, but we're thinking based on a briefing document signed by senior people in the ministry, presented to me by the chief of the defense staff and the deputy as the truth, which says that the death of the Somali is perplexing. It wasn't perplexing to anybody who had eyes to see, if you looked at the picture. So it was a terrible experience. And I was fighting the department to, you know, respond to the problem, and I brought in my, as I say, my deputy, my former deputy, because I needed, because he was well respected. But it was a very different relationship, because in the Justice Department, you have the minister's staff and you have the department. And we worked incredibly well with great mutual respect. In the Department of National Defense, you have the minister, you have the civilian staff, and you have the uniform staff. So it's kind of like at a triangle in which the minister is sort of the hypotenuse. And the other two have much more shared interests, in a sense, than either of them does with the minister's staff, because they're there forever. And that was hard. But, you know, again, being a lawyer, it was just such a part of the way I thought. You know, even though I didn't practice law, but there was a notion of legality and due process and all of those things that were just a part of my way of thinking, and continues to be. And when I go around the world now, you know, working with people who are trying to build democracies and talking about what the rule of law is and what are the things that one needs to do, or what are the ways that one can use the law to preserve democracy. So I was just in Kyrgyzstan on a project about their media is going digital. And what that means is that there's going to be a huge capacity for content. And they have a number of different ethnic groups, and the question is, how can they make an inclusive national media? And they were very interested to hear what I was talking about in Canada, that not only do we have our challenge to preserve our French-speaking population, but that our English-speaking population is challenged by the existence of a huge media market that speaks the same language outside our borders, and that depicts a reality that is not the reality of our country. And so we have had to create policies to make sure that our own voices are heard, because they have a Russian population with Russia. They have an Uzbek-speaking population with Uzbekistan, a Tajik-speaking population with Tajikistan. And if they don't have some policy to enable those people to speak the language of Kyrgyz Tajik speakers, Kyrgyz Uzbek speakers, Kyrgyz Russian speakers, as well as their own native language, which is more like, in a sense, well, like we have Quebec preserving an island of a language, although in Kyrgyzstan, nobody outside Kyrgyzstan speaks French, so they don't even have, you know, the chance of importing Kyrgyz content from another country as we do from France. But we do need to protect that island above our friends. But they were really quite interested to hear about our example. But again, there's this, you know, how you create the law, how you create policy that can achieve certain kinds of goals and ends. So it's the, you know, the law and policy are two sides of the same coin, that you create the policy and then you structure the laws that enable you to actually enforce that. How will you do that? Will it be providing carrots? Will it be having sticks? Will it be, you know, what will be the regulatory framework within which you try to make these things happen in a way that achieve your goal? And so, from my view, getting a law degree was one step in the part of the development of my career as a policymaker. Ongoing career as, you know, an advisor to people who are trying to become democratic policymakers.
I wonder if we should go ahead quickly to the 1993 and the and your time as prime minister.
Short happy life as prime minister.
Yes.
Well, again, throughout that process of my time in Parliament, we had the Mitchell Accord, which was an attempt to amend the Constitution. That failed. And then the defection of Lucien Bouchard, which took our Quebec caucus away. I mean, our caucus was still there, but our Quebec vote had defected. And, as my colleague said, would say, you know, the Bloc candidate in my riding is a total unknown. He's already running ahead of me. That was a very terrible political move. And then we tried the Charlottetown Accord, and I was on the Unity Committee of Cabinet. So again, that was an interesting process of looking at constitution building in the wake of the patriation. And we knew, I mean, that we were very low in the polls, and that our Prime Minister in particular was very unpopular. And my Chief of Staff, who I actually just saw this morning, is Ray Castelli, wrote me a memo in the fall of 92 saying that he didn't think the Prime Minister would go because he'd met with the campaign team and he couldn't, you know, create the campaign even if he wasn't going to lead us into a campaign. But he said on the off chance that he does go, here are the things you have to think about if you want to run as a leadership candidate, because a lot of people have been talking about it. In fact, when I was Minister of State for Indian Affairs, I used to go and speak at people's ridings and they'd say, you know, when Mulroney goes, you're going to be our next leader. It's a bit worrisome because if there ain't no vacancy, you don't want to be seen as being a candidate. So anyway, it was in, I guess, February of 1993 that the Prime Minister announced he was going to step down and there'd be a leadership convention in June. So we were already well into our fifth year of the mandate, and you never stay that long in government. Only under extreme circumstances would you hold off calling an election. Would you paint yourself into that corner by waiting to the last minute? And so he announced he was stepping down, and about 2/3 of the caucus supported me. It was very weird. And others, like Perrin Beattie, wanted to run, and he finally decided not to, because people want whatever they want Kim. I just had a strong groundswell. Mike Wilson wanted to run, Barbara McDougall wanted to run. And so it was almost like I could not run. I mean, it wasn't that I wasn't willing, but I knew, I mean, this was not the circumstance I would have chosen to run to be leader of the party, because the chances of our winning an election, some months before, Patrick Kinsella, who was, you know, a political operative out here, had said to me, you know, Tories are not going to win BC, and you'll be lucky to keep your seat. Which I probably could have if I'd been able to campaign out here, but I couldn't. That's the trouble when you're Prime Minister, you have to campaign across the country. So, make a long story short, I was elected leader of the party. Only one serious contender was Jean Charest. I won on the second ballot, almost won on the first ballot. It was interesting, you know, the media, well, you know, she didn't win on the first ballot. No political leader had won on anything before the fourth ballot. In my lifetime that I can remember. You know, Mulroney was fourth ballot, Trudeau was fourth ballot. I mean, you know, so I won almost on the first, I won a clear second ballot victory. And I used that. But we were all exhausted. You know, we'd had the referendum campaign in the fall of 92, then a leadership campaign, and the Prime Minister had said that he thought any minister who stepped down to be leadership candidates and not from cabinet, he would see that as being disloyal, whether he thought that we were criticizing or something, if we weren't bound by cabinet solidarity. But that meant that I was running the Defense Department while I was a leadership candidate, and it was very tricky because I had to be sure that I wasn't campaigning on the public nickel. And since defense is a very traveling portfolio, it meant a lot of work in separating out travel for defense and travel for campaigning. It was really, really hard. It made it much harder. So I won, but I had to drop the writ in September. I could have, in theory, hung on another couple of weeks, but because we'd had the referendum in the previous November, if we waited another more than a year for the election, we'd have to have a whole new enumeration. And although in reality, it probably would not have cost any more because you have the extra, you know, election day registrations and all these other kinds of things. And after a year, the electorate has moved and changed, whatever. But the perception would have been, remembering the concern about the deficit laws and whatever, the perception would have been that I was costing taxpayers, you know, $15 million for another 2 weeks of power kind of thing. So realistically, I had to call the election to be held before the anniversary of the referendum. And we were right at the end of the mandate anyway, so that would have only had about another couple of weeks before the constitutional hook came up to pull me off the stage. So, anyway, I had an interesting experience because the day after the leadership convention, I met with the clerk of the Privy Council because I was technically the prime minister designate. I had been elected leader of the governing party. So he met with me to discuss what would happen next. And I think he was the one that was in touch with Brian already to agree that the 25th, 12 days hence, would be the handover date because I had to create a new cabinet and do all of that kind of stuff. So he presented me with a binder that included all of the promises that I had made, the positions that I had taken as a leadership candidate, with options for implementing them. In other words, they'd followed my campaign and so that I could hit the ground running. They had some proposals and possibilities. You know, I said I would make cabinet smaller, for example. Now, so I didn't take all of their suggestions, but they brought through, you know, Robert DeCotre had done a study and they gave his recommendations and several others. And I was able to look at possibilities and combine them with my own ideas to do a restructuring of the ministry, which is a prime ministerial prerogative, which I had to do before I could appoint a cabinet. I met with the head of the campaign. Robert had told me that the campaign team was the best that was really available. And I met with John Tory, who was the campaign chair. He hadn't a clue what I had said or what I had been about as a candidate for the leadership. He said, well, I remained neutral during the campaign because I was campaign chair. And I said, but does that mean disengaged? You know, here is the clerk of the Privy Council, who is non-political, but whose job it is to serve the Prime Minister, doing what was necessary to do to serve me so that I could hit the ground running and particularly make decisions I needed to make before I was even sworn in. I could assume office. And yet, and this, I mean, I should have at that moment fired him as campaign chair. But one of my weaknesses was that I was not an experienced campaign manager. I'd always been the candidate. So I understood that there were people who had real skills in running campaigns. Those weren't my skills. I mean, I wasn't out to lunch about it, but it wasn't, you know, I understood there were people who knew how to manage the structure of putting everybody together, all the different teams. And that wasn't my strength, although I certainly wanted to have an input on the content of the campaign. But I was flabbergasted. But there was so little time. And my cousin, who was a longtime Tory from Ontario, was really aggravated later. He didn't have a chance to talk to me about it because he thought that he'd seen John Tory run a campaign for Frank Miller, thought he was terrible. But, you know, Brian already said, oh, these are very good people. Well, the problem is, and as it came to be clear, they hadn't really thought about running a campaign for me. Everything from the fact that the temperature of everywhere was always really cold because Mulroney liked things cold. And I mean, and no understanding of how to run a campaign for a woman. And the women on my team were struggling to get them even to do an event for women. They finally did one in Toronto. It was too late. And these women were saying, oh, if only we'd known. You know, it was just a very badly run campaign. The famous ads, which I never saw, we had talked about negative ads, and I had said, if you want to do negative ads, they have to be true. And one of the things you should do is maybe look at, you know, things like Cretien, the clips of him in the House saying, the national debt doesn't matter, we only owe it to ourselves. Because to me, that's a damning kind of thing to say. And you put that up and, you know. Because with negative ads, they are effective. But if they're effective, you have to say, how are they going to get them off the air? And that's, you know, for example, in the 88 campaign, the anti-free traders did a really good ad where they show somebody, say, oh, one more line, and they take a blackboard brush and rub out the border between Canada and the United States. United States. And it was a very effective and emotionally button-putting, pushing ad. The way they got rid of it or neutralized it was simply to do another ad where somebody says, oh, one more line, and they draw the line. Now, you may think that's kind of silly, but it had the effect of kind of neutralizing the other ad. So when you have a negative ad, you have to say to yourself, what are they going to do to get it off the air? It may be effective, but what are they going to do to get it off the air? So they do these stupid ads. And they tell me the night before, we're putting out some negative ads tomorrow, and there's a picture of Jean Chrétien, and it's sort of like the one that was on the cover of Maclean's. And we've done these with liberal focus groups, and they don't see any problem.
These are the ones showing his lopsided.
It didn't even really do that, but the point is, it wasn't a flattering picture of him. Mm-hmm. And Jean Chrétien's a very handsome man, actually. Mm-hmm. But because he had this nerve damage in his face, when he speaks in certain ways or smiles, his mouth goes. And the point was that in choosing that picture, it wasn't the most unflattering picture of him, but it wasn't a flattering picture of him, and it was one that could easily be construed as kind of making fun. But it wasn't even the picture. Mm. It was the voiceover of somebody saying, I'd be embarrassed to have this man as my prime minister. Mm. Not about how he looked, but we're saying that, trying to make the... It just was... Mm. I didn't see it. I had no idea what they were doing. And it was... And when I... So I wake up one morning, and these ads have started. And the press are asking me about them, and I haven't seen them. Mm. And I said, well, I didn't want to do anything that was offensive. You know, what are you going to do? I couldn't see them until I was in Quebec City that night. Finally, somebody brought me a tape so I could see them because I was out doing things. I had no opportunity to see them. And in those days, we didn't have things like smartphones and things where you could have been sent a video to see them. And I looked at it, and my heart just sank. And my stepdaughter was with me, and I said, you know, whose side are they on? I felt I'd been sabotaged because it was so stupid. And pointless. And of course, to this day, Alan Gregg and his team think I was wrong to pull them. Now, in my riding, conservatives are pulling the signs down on their yards. I mean, Penny Colonnette has said that they never had better fundraising than after those ads. I mean, it was a great fundraising ad for the Liberals. Mm. It was a disaster. Mm-hmm. And they think I was wrong to pull them. Anyway, this has nothing to do with going to law school, but I mean, it has.
Well, it brought the sympathy for the underdog into college.
And he got to use a line he'd been waiting to use for 30 years. God made me this way, you know. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is that I get on well with Jean Chrétien, and he knows I didn't have anything to do with those ads. And we've always, you know, I mean, if he thought I did, he probably would like maybe name me to Consul General of Los Angeles. And I just saw him on our trip to South Africa, and you know, we get on very, very well. We have mutual respect, and he likes me, and I like him too. And the funny thing is that I would never make fun of how somebody looks. But I didn't agree with his positions. And when he said, you know, we only owe it to ourselves, you know, I remember when he was in Pearson's cabinet, when they refused to redeem some Depression-era bonds because the interest rate was so low. And, I mean, it was a total breach of government obligation. And my grandmother happened to hold some of those bonds. Hmm. And they said, oh, well, most of them were sold off long ago to other people. And I said, well, my grandmother's weren't. But even if they were, the government, you know, your word is your bond. Mm-hmm. The government of Canada bond. If somebody sells them in good faith to somebody who's willing to hold them longer, you know, why that person should take a loss. I mean, it was outrageous. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, we don't just owe it to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We owe it to a lot of other people. You know, people who buy our debt. And what does that mean? We don't have to worry about our debt. Mm-hmm. If you want to say we don't have to worry about our debt because we'll always have enough money to pay it and it's not a sufficiently high percentage of the GDP that it's going to cause any problems and we're going to, you know, we can fund it, it's, you know, we can get good rates, blah, blah. There's lots of arguments. But that we only owe it to ourselves so we don't have to worry about it? Not quite. And I thought that would be a great thing to put in an ad. Mm. If you could use the clip from Parliament, all the better. Mm-hmm. If not, you could use the audio. If not, you could just, you know, represent the words. I mean, to me, so that's going negative, and it's where you're going after this person. But you're doing it based on something true, not based on something false, or based on something that can be seen as being mean or
whatever. It's like the conservatives going after Justin Trudeau. I saw the ads, one of the ads, and I think big mistake. First of all, don't give him attention. You know, don't comment on his famous name. Because guess what? Some people think that's important. You know, it's called dynasties, and I don't like them in politics. But, you know, don't, that's his strength. Don't play to it. You know, and they stopped. I mean, they realized it was kind of counterproductive. But it was a very, very difficult experience. And our vote was basically divided into five. It was a five-party race, which it hadn't been. In 1988, the free trade agreement turned out to be the issue that kept the Mulroney coalition together. Because it had started to fissure between 84 and 88. The issue over the aircraft maintenance contract in Winnipeg and things like that. There were a lot of, you know, it was an uneasy coalition with some soft nationalists in Quebec and Westerners. But in 88, it was held together, people who didn't like Trudeau, it was anti-Trudeau in the West. In 88, the West supported the free trade agreement, Quebec supported the free trade agreement, and John Turner actually convinced people that if he were elected prime minister, he would abrogate the free trade agreement. Now, the Liberals always say one thing and do another. And that's, I'm not saying this as a partisan way, it was Trudeau, like, you know, no wage and price control, Zapier frozen, so Nick as he gets in, he does wage and price control. I mean, they always do this, I mean, which is why at first the media didn't take Turner seriously, about, oh, this is just the Liberals saying, you know, it's like, we're going to get rid of the GST. No way you're going to get rid of the GST, you know, because the GST was not a conservative platform. It had nothing about it. It was the best alternative in a very difficult situation of a tax that had to be replaced. And in fact, the U.S. is even now talking about bringing in a multi-stage value-added tax because they realize, however aggravating these value-added taxes are in the sense of the complexity of their implementation, it's also what makes them hard to evade. And they tend to be fairer for that reason, that you actually collect them. And they, you know, nobody likes them, but they're actually, as a way of raising revenue, one of the better ways. And we had a tax that was killing jobs. And so there was no way they were going to get rid of it. So people didn't believe Chrétien when he said that. Maybe Sheila Copps believed him, to her detriment. But John Turner actually convinced people in 88 that he would cancel the free trade agreement. And so people who wanted to vote reform couldn't risk it. Because they said, we vote reform, we get the Liberals to get in. Because we'll split the vote, the West. And that would be against us. But we had no such issue in 93. So the Reform Party, which by that time had, you know, gone on about what, you know, crooks everybody was in politics, and, you know, everybody's at the trough and all this stuff, of course, then they get elected and they discover how expensive it is to be a member of parliament and how much, you know, maybe a pension's not a bad idea, especially if people think that you're a bunch of crooks and don't want to hire you after you're cut off. And you don't get, I mean, I don't have a parliamentary pension or a prime ministerial pension, I have none, because I wasn't in parliament long enough. A lot of people think I do. Nope, I have nothing. I earn a living like everybody else. And our Quebec vote had defected to the Bloc. And it may have been hard for people to imagine that Quebecers would vote for a party that couldn't conceivably form a government. But they did. So, you know, we got almost as many votes. We got more votes than the official opposition. But because our votes were spread out around the country, we had a disaster. But it is interesting that we got more votes than the party that formed the official opposition. Nature wants us to. But the result was that there was no way I could continue. Women don't get second chances. And, you know, I had basically, you know, Sharon Carstairs and said, don't be a Mulroney sacrificial lamb. But it was hard. I mean, it was, you know, it's hard not to. You know, people want you to lead them. And the only thing was that the last 2 weeks of the campaign, Jean Charry just got off the national campaign and went home and campaigned in Sherbrooke so that he won his seat. And I didn't have the luxury of doing that. So my campaign manager decided that I should lose my seat, that it would be better for me if we were going to lose and I didn't have my seat. Didn't discuss it with me. But I made that decision. So anyway, but... So that was it, and that was very disappointing. It was disappointing because I loved what I did in public life. But then the thing is to figure out what you could do. And writing a memoir was very useful because I was struck by how consistent I had been through my life. Mm. And it helped me to think about what were the things that mattered to me. Mm. And then to figure out how to make a life where I could build on that and use my experience constructively and earn a living. So that's where I've been since then. But again, being a lawyer is just an integral part of that. And in so many ways, it's a bit, I would say having been prime minister is like having gum on your shoe. And I suppose being a lawyer is a little bit like having gum on your shoe. Even if you're not practicing, it's such an integral part of how you get around.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the of these recorders is full, so we should wind down. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
It was a wonderful journey from Port Alberni to
back to the Vancouver.
So, thanks very much.
My pleasure.